Hey guys, welcome and thanks for tuning in. My name is Richard Osborne and this is the Expert Language Trainer Podcast. Welcome to episode 2 of the Expert Language Trainer Podcast, season 2, with me, Richard Osborne. Wanted to talk today about a Facebook group that I started this week on the ELT.training Facebook page that's run by Tamara Parsons. The group is a 5-day challenge, the back to school challenge, where Tamara is recording a new video or doing actually a live video every day, inviting the teachers who are members of the group to talk about the things they struggle with their teaching, things that they can talk about as a group. Tamara is giving advice, but I think she's also mostly acting as a kind of arbiter on between people to get them to help each other out and to contribute their stories and to talk about what they do that could help other people in the group. And I think it's a great idea. I've been watching some of the videos. I really enjoy them. Just finished watching one there where I'm not going to be able to link it in the podcast because you have to be a member of the group to get in. But if you're listening to this and you're a trainer, I'll put the link in the description of the podcast. Just go there, or you can go to Facebook and search for ELT.training as a page, and you'll see it. It's like a logo, a white logo with little spots on it, little red spots on it. Get in there and you'll find the link to the group that you can click on to join this 5-day challenge. And yeah, so I won't be able to show you the content, but I'll give you an overview of what was talked about in the recent episode because it was something that was very interesting to me. And I couldn't help it listening to Tamara talking about the issues that people were bringing up, the teachers in our group were bringing up, that she held back greatly from actually giving what, as she said very explicitly, from saying what she thinks you should do, and rather that people contribute. And having a lot of thoughts myself, running this podcast and doing training courses for other language trainers, of course, I had very strong opinions about some of the things that she was saying. So I wanted to sort of separately from the group make that into a podcast episode because I think there were some really key fundamental points and it will really help me get this season started off with some very concrete and practical things. But there you go. I've already been introducing it for 2 minutes and 20 seconds. So let's kick it off with planning. So planning is one of the first things that people seem to mention. They mentioned it in a previous webinar video challenge that Tamara did on her Facebook page a lot. And they're mentioning it again already at the beginning of this one. Planning seems to always be a sensitive point for a lot of language trainers. I think when we think about, if the question is, how do I plan my lessons better, or I have a problem with lesson planning or something like that, it's a question that depends on how long you've been teaching for, basically. We know that our industry, as I've said 100 times before, there's no way to get a good start in the industry other than just getting your experience, just, getting your feet wet and doing some language training. So you can do the CELTA, you can do the DELTA, you can do, masters in TESOL or whatever it is that you've done. And you'll get, a huge amount of information, especially from the DELTA and from the masters in teaching English. You'll get a huge amount of information from the 100 years of research that we have in our industry of different methodologies of language training, what makes them work, what makes them not work, criticisms and things, research supporting them or whatever, and that's great. You will also have some teaching practice that'll be very structured, and you'll do, for example, in the DELTA or in the CELTA, you'll do these very precise structured lesson plans. So you'll sit for hours structuring the perfect lesson from minute 1 to minute 60, exactly what you're going to do at every minute and why and etc. and what you're going to end up with at the end. So I think most people have probably done something like that. I'm sure even in the sort of simple TEFL certificates, that's something people have done. It's like the easiest analogy would be like, it's like learning to drive. You learn all this great theory, you do it all very precisely when you're in the car and you're with the instructor or you're doing your test, and there's like all these point checks you have to do and you have to look in a certain direction or whatever. And then once that's finished and you have your license and you have your own car and you get out on the road, then a lot of that just disappears and you start learning how you're going to do it your way, how you're going to drive your way, right? And everyone has their own particular way of driving. That's why when you're sitting as a passenger in someone else's car, sometimes it'll be that you're really calm, and sometimes it'll be that you're like, you know, putting your foot on the invisible brake because they scare the crap out of you. So everybody has their own way, and it might not be your way. I see teaching like that. Everyone has their own way of going into a classroom and inspiring learning, which is what we're doing. We're trying to create the environment where people can learn. We're not teaching necessarily as in, oh, I'm a better teacher than you because I can deliver the content better than you. I think that's complete nonsense. I think it's, I'm a better teacher than you. I mean, not that there should be a competition anyway, but you know, let's just imagine I'm a better teacher than you because I'm able to create an environment where it's extremely conducive to learning. So people who sit in a classroom with me feel this amazing energy of that is created, that they're being exposed to language that's just seeping into their system, and they come out feeling like, wow, I don't know how I did it, but I speak English a bit better, or I'm able to listen a bit better. You know, they feel this incredible change happening within them that they might not if they just sit with a book and learn English from a book, or if they sit with a teacher who's a bit more scholarly and who just reads grammar explanations from a book and gets them to do gap fill activities from a book and writes up their errors on the board and goes through them sort of one by one very meticulously without leaving much space for general discussion. I can't remember what the point I was trying to make was. Yes, that's right. You can be the greatest teacher in the world in the theory part of it, so in the South or in the Delta, but then you get out and you get your feet wet and you start realizing, how am I actually going to do this my own way? And I think at that point, you start your journey between when you're trying still to do these very specific, very precise lesson plans, and when you the point where you are quite spontaneous, like, so the point after, let's say, 2 or 3 years of teaching, if you're teaching full-time, 2 years, 3 years, you're at the point where you start really just knowing what to do without having to plan it. So when you walk into a classroom, you've got a 90-minute class, you know sort of what you're going to teach, and you have some materials to back you up. Maybe you have a video with a worksheet, and you know that the video has something to do with past simple grammar and, you know, practicing, you know, not just, let's put it the right way, not you go in with something that's got past simple grammar in it, which is something that a lot of people would even say who are good teachers, consider it from the perspective of you're going to go in to help somebody talk about the past more easily. You know, even just simple things like that. This relates to another part of planning that seems to be a problem for people, which is objectives. So, you know, how do you know what you're going to get at the end of the lesson? How do you test it? How do you make sure that you achieve that objective? So you want to teach them the past simple, you know, that's already a kind of mistake in a way that's going to make that very difficult for you to actually verify and to stick to. Because teaching someone the past simple is kind of, it's not a real phrase. It's not right in itself. You can't just teach somebody the past simple, right? You can teach yourself the fundamental principles grammatically of what it is to have a past simple grammar in your language and how that manifests in English in a certain, you know, very clinical, very overview kind of sense. You know, if you look up past simple on Wikipedia, you'll see a page with loads of information about what it is to have past simple and what, you know, variations there are, whatever. If somebody buys a grammar book, you know, here in France, you have great books that are like French and English, and they compare the French sentences in the past with the English sentences in the past. So this gives you a great kind of technical idea about what the past simple is. But that's not a teaching objective if you're doing a language course where the idea is to help people speak because they want to speak better, because they want to speak more easily, they want to speak in a greater variety of situations. They want to speak with less hesitation. They want to speak making less mistakes, but in the sense of not bothering the brain of their listener, of their the person they're speaking to as much, because it obviously bothers people a little bit every time you make a mistake that's a non-native mistake. So, you know, odd times if I'm speaking French, I can use the wrong masculine feminine from time to time, and it's annoying people a little bit. You can see that they would rather they didn't do that, you know, or it's giving them a little goosebumps or whatever, but it's not a big deal. But if I'm making loads of really fundamental mistakes in every sentence, then that could really disturb somebody who's trying to understand and who's used to just understanding fluidly. if you're making a lot of mistakes, then that fluidity is broken, and you're going to be an uncomfortable person to talk to. So that, you know, a lot of people's objective is to reduce the percentage of mistakes, or the quantity of mistakes, the frequency, let's say, of their mistakes, not to eliminate them completely, because you just can't. If you want to speak, you're always going to make mistakes if you're a non-native speaker. Even if you're a native speaker, you're going to make mistakes. You know, read a Guardian article today. There's always one of them somewhere that somebody's written with a mistake in it. And it's mostly written by, you know, so-called native speakers. Anyway, I've gone off on a mad digression. Yeah. So, you know, getting to that objective, walking into the class and saying you're going to teach someone past simple wrong, walking into the class and saying the functional objective. So if you look up, one of the teaching theorists or approaches, I suppose, that exists, this idea of the notional functional syllabus, where we stop saying things like teach them the past simple, teach them the future with will, rather say what that's actually, what are they going to be able to do? So I did hear Tamara at one point mention skill-based lessons. And actually for me, skill-based lessons, if you want to have a bit of an easier time planning and setting objectives, skill-based lessons is kind of a good way to do it. Because if you say not, I'm going to teach this person past simple, but you say, I'm going to teach them how to talk about their previous holiday more easily with the correct vocabulary and the correct forms of the verbs, then that makes total sense. That's pretty easy to hit in terms of a target. And actually, here's another thing about planning. If I were to say that I had a 90-minute class, right? Imagine I say the objective of this 90-minute class is to, I could just say, get someone to speak about their past holiday using the right vocabulary and the right form of the verb. So I have a vocabulary objective and a grammar related objective, which is the, you know, verb forms in the past. So, you know, it'll be ED stuff. It'll be irregular verb stuff. It'll be pronunciation with T or D or whatever for ED verbs, all that kind of stuff. You know, I don't know if I'll squeeze all that in one class if they've never looked at it before. Maybe if it's the first time they're ever touching the past simple, I'll stick with irregular verbs and regular ED forms and not worry too much about their pronunciation, you know, whatever. In fact, that kind of, that digression fits well into what I'm trying to say, as they often do. You know, my digressions do have a point. There's a reason I let my brain run completely wild when I'm talking. You get these little nuggets to fall out. The idea is that the lesson itself, the 90 minutes, if you're doing a CELTA, a DELTA, a Masters in TESOL, whatever, and you're learning about lesson planning, one of the things they'll probably tell you is, you have to account for every minute of those 90 minutes. Now, maybe people are going to tell me I'm wrong, or maybe the people who taught me CELTA and DELTA were too strict, or I don't know what. But, you know, for me, I always had this impression that the client is paying for 90 minutes. Every minute should be related to that objective. Everything I do, planned or not, you know, should be related to that objective. I know that in the course, they would tell you, don't worry if you divert from your plan a little bit, because they mentioned something and you want to, you know, have a discussion about it, and just for, you know, a bit of fluency practice, but you should always have in mind what it's related to in terms of objectives and skills. And then at the end of the lesson, you can say, oh yeah, I taught them how to speak about the past and their holiday, and we diverted a bit and also talked about how to talk about, you know, past jobs or something like that. And so, you know, I invented an objective on the spot. I think that's probably the best way to look at any lesson, is there has to be some sort of flexibility in there. So I would say the 90 minutes where we're often trying to pack them full and doing this minute by minute plan of what we're going to do from minute zero to minute 90, I would say, why not? And what's the problem with saying 30 minutes, 45 minutes, say half of this class is going to be dedicated to really hammering home and pushing the learners towards the conversation on past holidays, so that I can make sure that they definitely make mistakes. And this is where Tamara also talked about the PPP and TTT approaches for your lesson planning for this part of the lesson where you want to do talking about your past holiday. The structure of that could be, or should be rather, in my opinion, TTT, because I used it and it works. TTT is test, teach, test. It's a simple thing to remember. Test the learner on what they already know, so you can identify that there's truly a gap there, something that's missing. In this case, it would be that they say what they did on their last holiday, but they use a present simple form of the verb, or vocabulary-wise that they said what they did on their last holiday, but they have to use some of their first language to be able to fill in the gaps of, you know, vocabulary about what a hotel is or what a swimming pool is or something like that. The next T is teach. So test, what do they know? What do they not know? Where are the gaps? Teach is to fill in the gap that you intended to fill because you've planned this. And then test, again, is to make sure by asking them, again, some more questions about what they did in the last holiday, you test that they're actually, they've integrated what you've told them in the teach section so that they can actually bring out that new language. If it's new vocabulary, that you ask them again what they did on another holiday and they say, oh yeah, there was a swimming pool. You're like, yep, I taught them that word and they just repeated it. Therefore, that's had an impact at least, and maybe at most, they've understood what you told them. And that's a really, really important point just to repeat again, because it relates to a wider issue on, you know, how much can you really teach someone and assure that they've learned and acquired something. You do TTT at the end of your 90 minutes, you can be reassured that at some point within those 90 minutes, they heard and understood what you said enough that they could replicate it themselves so they can use the past forms of certain verbs. And you can say at the end of that lesson, yep, for sure, they can use go in the past, they can use saw in the past, they can use visit in the past, you know, happy days. What you cannot say is that in 3 days, if you ask them to do the same thing again, that they will remember any of it. And that's a really big point. Maybe I'll, you know, be gravitating around that a lot during this podcast, is to try to be conscious of the sensitivity. There's a word for it probably. I'll think of it later and I'll come back to it and add it somewhere else. But there's a kind of arrogance, I suppose, in a way, of the basic principles of teaching that exist already, where we say, if we've done TTT, then we've succeeded in something. And yes, you have. You've succeeded in deploying an effective lesson, but you have not succeeded yet in getting someone to learn, in quotation marks, something, in the sense that learn for me, and I think for learners who are paying for it, learn would be long-term memory. So long-term ability to recall what you've taught them in that lesson. So that's one way you can do your small portion of this 90 minutes that you really want to focus on hammering in a particular point. Could be TTT. PPP is the same thing. Present, practice, produce. You present the content that you are going to do with the learner and see where there's gaps in what they understand. You practice, that means you've taught them something and now you're doing it in a controlled way. So giving them some sentences to do that specifically practice the exact things that you taught them. So that's a test in a way, but a very specific and constrained test of what you've taught them. And produce is like a nice additional bit to tests, which is you've done the very restrictive test, then try to get them to say something naturally from the heart, you know, and so to speak, that would involve the thing that you've taught them. So you can prove a little bit further that you've taught them something right, because you can prove that they've integrated it into their language system to the point where they can actually bring it out almost spontaneously, or at least naturally, in a sentence that you haven't prepared or that they haven't prepared. So if you just say, okay, that was that holiday, tell me about the one the year before, and they go into a different story and they're able to pull out the same expressions in that different story, then that would be the produced part, where it shows that they're able to use it more freely to do freer practice. And again, that's great. And if you can achieve that within those 90 minutes, I don't really see why you couldn't just leave the other 90 minutes, or the other 45 minutes, or say, you know, 30 minutes or 50 minutes, whatever it is, whatever the other portion of your class is, that you haven't planned, as in you haven't set out exactly what you're going to do, why you shouldn't just be able to kind of riff a bit and just see what the learners are interested in talking about. Maybe it's going to be related to your language point. That would be great. If it's not and you can't push them in that direction, don't worry too much about it. There's a great approach that I really enjoyed using myself when I was teaching full-time, which was the dogma approach. It sounds a bit of a funny name, but it's related to a cinema movement, a cinematography, filming movement that Scott Thornberry, the language teaching writer, picked up on and adopted the name for his own teaching approach. Dogma is the idea that planning a lesson is kind of counter to effective learning, in the sense that if you go in with a preordained lesson, you're not taking advantage of the things that are interesting to the learner at that particular moment, at that particular day. You're also not contextualizing it enough, and you're not taking advantage of some of the context that exists in what that learner is bringing to the class, some stuff that they could just be bringing naturally into the class that would have automatic meaning for them. You're not taking full advantage of that. So the great example is going into a class with a sugar packet and just saying the lesson today is about this sugar packet and just putting it on the table and being like, right, what are we going to talk about? You have no idea what you're going to do vocabulary-wise, language-wise, grammar-wise. You just are going to spark conversation in the group. You're going to see where it goes. You as the teacher, and this is where experience comes in. So that's why I said 2-3 years minimum for this kind of stuff. You'll be able to pick up immediately on certain things that they're doing that are typical mistakes for that particular culture of non-native English speakers. So sitting in a room of French people, and I hear them starting to talk about the sugar packet, and they use some false friends, and I say, right, okay, well, let's have a look at these false friends on the board. That is something that you can do spontaneously. You can develop it into a lesson. So the test part comes naturally, and it's actually coming from the learners. So you see what they don't know with your intuition, listening to what they're saying. And then using your experience, you're able to just pull out of your sleeve a quick lesson that you would do on the board or just orally with them to explain, to do the teach part or the present part. So show them the kind of language that you have picked up on and what way they can do it better, what way they can express that better. And then go into a practice activity that you just spontaneously create yourself, where you're looking to see if they're able to put it into practice in a controlled way, in a freer way. But it's something that you've created yourself. So you just, pull a role play out of your hat or get them to start making, a news report together or whatever. You just use the experience you have of the different types of activities that are available to spontaneously create a learning activity that will show that they've assimilated the information that you give them based on what they did at the beginning. So why do that? First of all, it accounts for that other bit of the class that I was saying about. So if you've planned a bit where you're going to talk about past holidays, there could be space there before and after to just let, for example, when the learners come into the class, they're coming in with a lot of thoughts. They maybe have just got off the phone with somebody and they had a deep conversation about some subject, or yesterday they went somewhere really interesting. So they're coming in with, you have no idea what. You can draw some of that out of them and spend the first 20 minutes just looking at one, micro language point. So draw some stories out of them, get a little language point you weren't prepared for, but you know because you've got the experience, you know it really well. Stick it up on the board, do some work, do a quick activity. And then after that 20 minutes is done, move on to now we're going to talk about past holidays, the theme of today. Bam, 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 you do your test, teach, test. Then after that, there's a little bit of space as well for miscellaneous. So what else can we talk about using the past simple? Or what else can we do talking about a holiday? Maybe you end up talking about comparatives and superlatives because somebody starts comparing their holiday to someone else's holiday or the best holiday they've ever had or whatever, so you don't focus too much on, is this the right past simple or whatever? Obviously, you're still going to be checking that, but you're going to move on to perhaps another language point. And then people would say, that's too many language points. You've planned 3 language points in one lesson. Yeah, well, whatever. You don't know if any of the 3 of them will be remembered, whether that would be more or less likely than just having one objective and hammering the past simple for an hour and a half. Not sure, because hammering something for an hour and a half, you might be actually shooting yourself in the foot. It might be counterproductive because they might get bored of your well-planned, well-structured lesson. They might not appreciate the lack of flexibility and the lack of ability to go off the track and have a little discussion about something that interests them. We have these things that we want to say spontaneously, and it could be something that really brings a bit of passion out when we're like, oh, I have a story. No, sorry, that doesn't fit into the plan. So keep your story to yourself. That's not what you want to do. You can say, no, we'll have time for that at the end. I just wanted to get to this, finish this activity. We'll finish this bit about, your past holiday. Can you keep your story in mind and we'll come back to it at the end? And then you really have time to exploit it and even get a little language point out of it. And maybe, just maybe, they won't even remember your planned language point, which is about past simple, but they will remember the comparative and superlative bit that they did just in a 20-minute spontaneous riffing session. Or the inverse, you have so little control over it I would say, why not hedge your bets and just try to go for broke and just do a bit of freedom and a bit of controlled stuff. So for me, planning, a lot of timing, error correction, all those things that Tamara was mentioning that are issues for people that can be improved already just by being a bit more flexible, being a bit more experimental, being a bit more liberal, trying to practice and train yourself after 2 or 3 years of being a teacher to lean on or leverage your existing knowledge of what it is to you know, the kinds of activities that exist and the language explanations that you've done 100 times already, so you can just pull out of your sleeve, you know, really leverage that and let that come out spontaneously. And, you know, I think that shows that you're a really good teacher. First of all, it'll impress the learners. They'll see somebody who's just able to, like, at the click of their fingers, pull out a bit of a language explanation about whatever you're talking about. You know, it makes you a bit of a language magician in a way. It's part of being an expert language trainer. And it gives you that freedom that you're not worried as much about, you know, have I hit exactly the targets that I was supposed to hit? And some people might be freaked out by, you know, that, like Tamara said, going outside of your comfort zone. Some people might be freaked out about that much freedom and, you know, maybe are there going to be long silences and people won't know what to say and we won't know what to do next. But when you're in a room with 2 or more people, normally that's never really the case. There's always something to talk about. And you're a teacher, it's kind of your job to drive the conversation. So that would be my advice about planning and all timing and whatever. Try that out. Try really just being more flexible with the timing in your next lesson and letting some bits run wild and just letting that, you know, look up Dogma. I'll put a link to the article on it in the podcast description, and that'll really help you with that. I wonder, and I would hypothesize that could also help with another problem that Tamara mentioned, of which I have not that much experience, but a little bit, which is teaching teenagers. Classroom management when it comes to teenagers, as Tamara said, is quite difficult. I would wonder, actually, because my own experience with teenagers is giving a bit of freedom when you're in a situation where they at least have some respect for you. And so, you know, you give them that bit of freedom in the lesson planning and the execution of the lesson. They might, you know, teenagers, maybe for me, the problems I've had with classroom management has been boredom and lack of interest. Teenagers need to be engaged and they're really difficult to engage. So if you give them a bit of freedom and actually let some of the content come from them and they have that freedom to talk about things that are interesting to them or passionate for them, that could be a way to help a bit with classroom management. If they feel like they are the ones driving the lesson, they're going to intrinsically be interested in what they're talking about because it'll be a teenage issue. And if you can manage to go along with that and to exploit that for a language point, but, you know, keeping it on their level, so keeping it something that's not just like scholarly sort of sit down, shut up and listen type stuff, but something that's actually speaking at their level, you know, communicating with them at their level and engaging with them at their level and not patronizing to them. I've always been a big believer in that. It doesn't apply to all situations, and I've had situations teaching teenagers where it's just been a riot because they've been from difficult backgrounds, difficult schools, you know, doing homework help outside of school because they were failing inside school. And, you know, I tried everything with those guys and it was, you know, it was very difficult. I know that the only times I ever managed to really feel like I had classroom management down was when I had them in smaller groups and when I was able to give them the freedom to kind of not work. That's what they want to do is not work. So giving them a bit of freedom to not work meant that for, I don't know, 25% of the class, they would actually do some work. So, you know, you might say that that's a complete waste of time, but I would rather that than trying to force them to work for 100% of the class and actually getting their attention for zero or very, very little because they're just resisting everything I do. I would much rather have their full attention for 25% where they feel like I'm really engaging them with an interesting story or we're doing some funny activity. Like one time I was getting them to text each other with emojis and because they all had their phones out all the time. So I was like, right, text each other a story with emojis. Think of it in your head in French. And get your friend to translate it and read it out loud in English. They had to like try to, you know, interpret the emoji text, which is like such a typically teenager thing to do. So they find it hilarious. And I managed to get their attention for 10, 20 minutes. And I taught them something. They were able to express themselves. I'd much rather that than just having them resist and be running riot all the time or not even coming back, which very often happened. They just didn't show up the next week if I was trying to be too strict with them. So I don't have that much experience, but I'm hoping that staying liberal will help you to deal with problems like this, and I would be interested to see in the Facebook group if anybody tries that out, you know, to see what their feedback is. I never get feedback to my podcast. So maybe if you go in the group, join it and get involved, you can tell me or tell Tamara what you've been doing in terms of free language training. So hope to see you in there soon, and take care.